Gender and Society, Two Conversations for Women's History Month, next on Soundings. This is Wine Pond at the National Humanities Center. My guests this week are Patricia Ebrey of the University of Illinois and Caroline Walker Bynum of Columbia University. Patricia Ebrey is here to talk about women and marriage in medieval China. Before that, Caroline Walker Bynum discusses gender, the human body, and religion in medieval Europe.
I think there's even what some people will see in this work is an anti-feminist bias, in that I'm saying that finally what people are ultimately afraid of goes beyond gendered experience. They are afraid of death and destruction itself, but that all along the way to that, religious experience is gendered in some very, very powerful and fundamental way.
Historian Caroline Walker Bynum. She'll be back in just a moment to talk about gender, the human body, and religion in medieval Europe. Later on Soundings this week, a conversation about women and marriage in medieval China. Partial funding for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Additional support for this edition of Soundings comes from the Chang Ching Kuo Foundation for International Scholarly Exchange. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Tabloids with headlines about 25-pound babies and women who get pregnant by aliens may make us smile. But stories like that are older than modern sensational journalism. In a way, they also reflect our preoccupation with issues that have always fascinated us: birth and death, the decay of the body, the meaning of our spirits. The sort of thing that one historian calls final questions. For Women's History Month, Caroline Walker Bynum, a professor of history at Columbia University, is here to describe how people in medieval Europe thought about final questions, religion, and the human body. Bynum says, for example, that for both Christians and Jews in the Middle Ages, the resurrection of the body was an important concern. But on the way to such final questions, according to Bynum, the issue of gender was also an important consideration. Bynum's most recent book is a collection of essays entitled Fragmentation and Redemption. One part of the book notes that for medieval people, gender rather than biological sex was the ultimate human category. Medieval males, for instance, tended to think of themselves as public or military, while women were apt to see themselves as essentially private and domestic. But public or private, medieval men and women cherished fervent hopes that their bodies would triumph over death. This was particularly evident in their devotion to the lives of the saints, accounts that drew upon both male and female experience to express fundamental religious truth. Caroline Walker Bynum.
One of the things that obviously interested medieval people in saints' lives was the exquisite tortures that were inflicted on the saints before death. The faces tend to be blank or angelic or ecstatic, and horrible things are happening to their bodies. This raises very interesting questions about reader response to the stories, right, or viewer response to the pictures. Were people sort of getting off on some kind of sadistic reaction? Were they identifying with some sort of masochistic experience? Or were they really seeing the kind of courage that we might see in a modern war movie, where mm-hmm. a young soldier kind of triumphs over adversity of some sort?
Well, what's going on here? I mean, how does this apparent disparity between torture and serenity and religious ecstasy, how does that go to the question of one's gender? Is there a particular relationship here?
Well, I think there both, again, is and isn't. There is, in the sense that it is particularly female bodies that tend to be tortured in these pictures. Mm-hmm. When you get male bodies tortured, it sometimes does seem to be in a kind of homosexual image. Saint Sebastian being pierced by arrows has clearly got a kind of a sexual torture overtone to it in a male sense. I think so. There's a gender element there, and there's no question that a certain amount of very negative, misogynistic, cruel, sadistic reaction to the female body is there in some of the viewer response to that. At the same time, I think ultimately in the triumph over pain and the assumption that beatific vision, that a visionary experience of God at a moment of intense pain or of death could transcend pain and death and give ultimate meaning. There is there's both a horror at what's happening and an identification with the triumph over what's happening that's going on in the viewer response to those pictures.
Is it fair to say, Caroline, that medieval people were simply more credulous, more apt, more inclined to belief than we in the modern world? Is that what accounts for this difference in our conceptions of the relationship between religion and the body?
I don't think so. One of the things that I do, and I think of this almost as research in preparation for the kind of topics I work on, is to read World Weekly News and the National Enquirer when I stand in the checkout line in the supermarket.
The most sensationalistic things
sure,
in our culture.
People in our culture believe that women are abducted by and impregnated by aliens, that gigantic babies are born that weigh 26 pounds at birth. This is regularly written up, and it's on the paper.
And this has a relationship to medieval saints and women?
It's exactly the same kind of stories that circulate in the Middle Ages. Some of these are age old, and they're as much believed or disbelieved, I think, in the 12th century as they are in the 20th. Uh-huh. They're for some people they're symbols, for some people they're literal. I think this was true in medieval society too. By the end of the Middle Ages, for example, this is another for instance for you, the stories of women's bodies triumphing over pain and death, corpses that are incorrupt after death, women who are tortured and don't show any marks on their body, this kind of thing, were examined quite scientifically, quote unquote, by lawyers and doctors at the papal court when they considered whether or not these women were truly saints. Indeed, one of the origins of the practice of autopsy is indeed the dissecting of holy bodies to look to see whether there is proof inside that the women were miraculous fasters, that they did not experience certain kinds of bodily events. So I think just as today you have some people who are, we would say, credulous, we would say superstitious, and some people who want scientifically to test this. But most people would admit that some parapsychological experiences mm-hmm. aren't fully scientifically explainable at this point. So I think for the Middle Ages.
It also goes to the odd medieval notion that Jesus Christ can be man and woman, has a feminine dimension to the characteristics of the Savior.
Right, and not only Jesus, but also the clergy, the priest. If you think even right down into the modern world, one of the things, if you go to Italy in a small town and you tap in even today to Italian anti-clericalism, you'll see little boys jeering the priest in the street because he wears skirts. Uh-huh. The priest is a role reversal in a very fundamental way, very masculine but also very feminine. The priest, indeed, if you think of the Mass as the essential Catholic ritual, what does the priest do at the altar? He makes the food. He distributes the food.
That's a feminine function.
That's a feminine role. The priest is the cook. He's the waiter. He's mm-hmm. the distributor of food. And the woman is the recipient. The woman, indeed, is not allowed behind the altar rail. She cannot touch the Eucharistic vessel. She cannot make the food.
Caroline, let me ask you to reflect on another large proposition. You scholars like to debate about questions such as the following. Medieval people were not only different and apart from us in space and in time, they were like another race of people. We will never be able to get into their minds. Another angle on that question is, oh, wait a minute, yes, we are all very much alike. We have human nature in common. Does that kind of question enter into your discussion of medieval people and the way they thought about religion and the human body?
It comes up all the time, and it comes up for me in teaching. I think the central thing that I try to do in what I write and in what I teach is to make people say, hey, wait a minute, that's really peculiar, isn't it? It's the strange,
exactly.
It's the unfamiliar that I want to just shove people's faces in, because I actually think that many of the problems that we face today in a multicultural society is our failure to understand how different other people are. I don't think the problem is creating a consensus that papers over difference. I think it is that we don't really admit the difference in the first place. We don't admit how hard it is to understand other people, and therefore we don't give them a chance to tell us what their experience is. And if we did, then there's some ultimate level at which the fact that they're humans too would mm-hmm. create some kind of bond of compassion and we could build.
So even though we share a common language and a common culture and we look about us and we have MTV and newspapers mm-hmm. and taxi cabs mm-hmm. and all of that, we are really very, very different creatures across this space of, what, 2 or 3 feet that separate us as we speak into these microphones.
Yes, and I think if we can recognize that and if we can encounter that in the sources from the past, mm-hmm. Then we'll be able to probe through that and come to the place where there are, and that's, of course, also what this book is about, there are essential human experiences, like birth and death. And so there are final places which go beyond, and this comes back to what I said earlier, go beyond even the particularities of gender, of class, of race, where it's death itself that we have to confront. But I think a greater danger is that we'll violate that specificity, particularity, unfamiliarity of the past or of other people on the way towards the essential human experiences. Well, anyway, that I think is the failure to recognize the unfamiliar that's the great danger.
Fair enough. Caroline Walker Bynum, I want to thank you for this overview of your book. Let me tell our listeners about you and it. You are a professor of history at Columbia University, and we're very pleased that you've just joined the board at the National Humanities Center. Here you are for your first meeting at the center. Your book is Fragmentation and Redemption, and the subtitle is Essays on Gender and the Human Body in Medieval Religion. It's available from Zone Books. Caroline, have you enjoyed your visit to the center?
Very much. Yeah. I'm a Southerner, and so it's nice to come home to the South, but it's my first time at the center, and it's a wonderful place.
Well, we're glad to have you on board. Good luck in your work.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed myself.
It's Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part 3 in a series of programs for Women's History Month, Women and Marriage in Medieval China. Join me now for a conversation with Patricia Ebrie, a professor of history at the University of Illinois. Ebrie is here to talk about her new book, The Inner Quarters. The book describes Chinese women and marriage in the Sung period, roughly 1,000 years ago, in a culture that embraced 100 million people, a population greater than that of Europe at the time. Patricia Ebrie examines the lives of Chinese women from perspectives that include concubinage and motherhood, dowries, divorce, and widowhood. She also writes about how medieval Chinese people understood the differences between men and women, with respect not only to biology, but social protocols as well. For example, medieval Chinese thinking separated men into categories of behavior such as the literary or the military, a person, for instance, of high education or artistic inclination. This thinking also gave rise to the belief that medieval Chinese women had to be ultra-feminine, a belief that in turn led to the practice of foot binding. Ebrie will talk about that in a moment. But first, I asked Patricia Ebrie to comment on one of the medieval Chinese customs that Westerners find both fascinating and repellent, the practice of arranged marriages.
Well, I don't think we can reject that stereotype. I think certainly in this period, in fact, until the early 20th century, no one really questioned the idea that parents choose their children's partners. For one reason, that they're very young. Mm-hmm. This is done when the girls are maybe 16, 17, 18, 19, and the husbands are 19, 20, 21, 22.
I know we have to make some careful distinctions, Pat Ebrie. I mean, we can say on the one hand that this is just blatant raw sexism. It is the exercise of power that discriminates against young women. On the other side, we can say, wait a minute, this is the age, the wisdom of maturity at work. mm-hmm. really doing good things in the lives of young people. How do you come to that?
Well, I don't think you can see this particularly as sexist, because this applies to the young men as well as the young women. Uh-huh. They're not picking their partners either. I think you'd have to see this as a much more generational thing. And actually, the women of the older generation are, this is one of the areas in which they have quite a bit of influence.
Now, are you cynical about this, Pat? Ibri, do you look at this practice in Chinese history and say, well, it was, essentially political and bloodless and devoid of human passion and romance? Or how should we look at it?
Well, to bring up those kinds of questions, to phrase it in terms of passion and romance, mm-hmm. is then to entirely take our categories and try to impose them on this. There is passion and romance. They are usually thought of as entirely separate subjects from this. Here we're concerned with the continuity of the family, and particularly patrilineal descent.
Let's talk about husband-wife relationships. We live in the 90s. We're all sensitive people. We live in a culture of therapy, some of the critics have said. Tell me about how husbands and wives interacted and what marriage was like 1,000 years ago in China.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, this is the kind of thing where you're having to look all sorts of different places to get your evidence. And so I could find things ranging from sort of medical manuals that give you advice on how to get pregnant and evidence of how many children people had and things like this. But after that, I have to deal mostly in stereotypes. Bossy wives, violent husbands, and maybe the biggest one of all, jealous wives.
All right, and does the record bear this out?
Well, the record bears it out if you assume that concubinage is a natural institution.
Mm-hmm.
That is
big assumption.
A big assumption, right. That where jealousy comes in is when the man has brought home one or more concubines who all live in the same house with the wife.
Uh-huh.
And then the women don't get along, and there's continual fighting and bickering.
All right, now let's pause on this, Pat Ibri. The concubine is a term that people in the West may know from reading the Old Testament. I don't want you to get into history of the word itself, but what was the practice like in the Song period in China?
Well, basically, you could say that China had monogamy. A man could only have one legal wife. On the other hand, there was no restriction in him buying other women.
That's a pretty harsh word, buying, purchasing?
Basically, yes. He would go to a broker, mm-hmm. and there would be girls who had been turned over to the brokers by their parents or sometimes kidnapped. I mean, kidnapping is discussed a great deal. It clearly happened. They could be, in a sense, sold, but more like kind of indentured as servants. Or in the case of a concubine, it would really be for her life.
All right. Now, does the word slavery come to mind here, or is that too harsh?
I think that's probably too harsh, because this is a recognized institution. You can consider it a form of marriage as well.
Uh-huh.
But it is the concubine definitely was of a lower social and legal status than a wife.
All right. Now, one of the associations that comes to mind when we use a word like concubine is the sexual association,
mm-hmm.
the sexual slave, that sort
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what we're doing here is sort of unpacking and circling some of these stereotypes. Talk to me about that.
Well, I would say there certainly is an aspect of that. If you just wanted someone to do housework, you could get a mate.
Mm-hmm.
That the concubine was supposed to be a mate for the man. She was also underneath the wife in terms of a household hierarchy and would be expected to do housework, make clothes and things of that sort
as well. Did these women, I don't know how else to put this, did they get along? Did they talk to one another? What was the emotional temperature like in these situations?
I think clearly it varied a great deal, but at least at the level of stereotypes, what people expected to happen was quite a bit of friction, and particularly people expected that violence might easily break out,
uh-huh,
that wives would beat the concubines, for instance.
And they did, I take it.
And they did.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, for example, with respect to the legal system, let's begin with the husband. Was he the one who was supposed to resolve these conflicts, or did they, in fact, get into the legal system?
That would rarely get into the legal system unless a concubine was beaten to death.
Mm-hmm.
The husband is supposed to, this is a Confucian term, regulate the family. He should be able to establish moral standards so that people get along well. On the other hand, it would be very hard to really challenge his wife in terms of her control over maids or concubines.
All right. Again, your book is called The Inner Quarters. The subtitle is Marriage and the Lives of Chinese Women in the Sung Period. Motherhood, that's a mm-hmm. wonderful large word that looms in our vocabulary. But what was it like for the Chinese people 1,000 years ago?
It certainly was a wonderful, warm category to them as well. And this is where women could really shine. Everything about their society supported their role as mothers. I mean, we today will often be suspicious of people's motives as mothers. Maybe they're trying to manipulate their children or they're trying to get something personally out of this. The Chinese almost never had that feeling. Mothers were assumed to only have the interests of their children in mind and to be sort of brimming with love and care.
Now, you have a chapter, Pat Ebrie, in your book on widowhood 1,000 years ago in Chinese history. Mm-hmm. Why does that mm-hmm. deserve a whole chapter by itself?
Well, the main reason is that it has played a very important symbolic role in Chinese understandings of women's virtues. That one of the real tests of a woman, how good a woman she is her ability to say she has made one commitment in life and stick with it. So that...
So she stays married to this man even though he's dead. I mean, that's obvious. But
yeah,
there
but
is
as
a,
an ideal virtue.
Yeah, there's a kind of a extra devotion.
And so there's a kind of cult of widow chastity. To take, you know, the extreme cases, the 19-year-old who is widowed and doesn't even have a child yet and yet still stays on in that family and adopts a child and becomes sort of this perfect woman.
Is this the culture of the victim?
Possibly. Well, I'm not sure that fits very well because these are portrayed as very strong women.
Mm-hmm. That is a modern conception.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of depictions of victims, but say the woman who is sold, the maid or concubine who gets beaten, this kind of thing. There's gets played up sort of an enjoyment of woman as victim. But the widows are portrayed as exceptionally strong. Uh-huh. Now, I don't want to mislead you. Most women, most widows in this period did remarry. I mean, ones who were widowed young.
Let's talk about a word that you used earlier in our conversation. We've been saving it here, and that is foot binding. Here is a practice which strikes us as bizarre, medically unsound, painful, et cetera, et cetera. The only analog that I can think of in our culture is spiked high heels and how unhealthy they're supposed to be for women's feet. Tell me about foot binding.
Well, I think they were an awful lot worse for women's feet than high heels, no matter how high those heels.
Right.
Because it did involve a genuine deformation of the body.
Now, why did the Chinese people practice this? What was at stake here?
It does seem to have spread as a fashion, and as nothing much more than a fashion, starting in the entertainment quarters, maybe even as a kind of binding for dancers, so they could sort of dance on their toes, something uh-huh. like this.
Was it possible to walk, even though one had experienced this awful
you
process?
You could walk, but you couldn't walk with any kind of the level of endurance of a person with natural feet.
Mm-hmm. Was it aesthetic? Was that the nature of it? This was something that was pleasing to the eye, and particularly the male eye?
It was definitely considered pleasing to the eye, something sort of marvelous, tiny. They would compare them to new moons, kind of arcs, slender, tiny.
Uh-huh.
And so you're getting into associations with women as, you know, slender, delicate, tiny.
Did it have anything to do with marriage? Was it part of the marriage ritual or ceremony?
Not of the marriage ritual, but it was considered part of women's attractiveness.
Uh-huh. Does it continue today?
No. No, this was one of the first aspects of women's situation which reformers in the late 19th, early 20th century picked on and decided we had to get rid of this. I think especially since Westerners found it so repulsive.
Pat Ebrie, your book is The Inner Quarters. You write about marriage and the lives of Chinese women 1,000 years ago. In fact, almost exactly 1,000 years ago. Do these conceptions and practices travel in time? I mean, are you looking at them because you are interested in knowledge for its own sake, or are you looking at them to talk to us about our present, about what's going
mm-hmm.
on today in China?
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly think that they carry into modern times in many ways, and particularly that knowledge of them helps, both for a Western audience just to see what is constructed, what things are common, what things probably relate to family institutions. It gives a different perspective on Western experience. Many of these basic forms persist through later dynasties in Chinese history. They don't persist all the way into the present. But one thing I tried to do in this book was show that women are still actors in a system like this. That is, actually, the emphasis in the book is not on oppression and sexism, but on how women could still act, that they are still creating their world in many ways. And this, I think, is important for, in a sense, to have a kind of history for women as well.
Pat Ebrey, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Here's a big order for you. How has marriage changed in China from 1,000 years ago in the Song period to what's going on today?
Well, legally, it's changed almost entirely. Parents can't legally force either sons or daughters to marry anyone against their will. Children must agree to a marriage. Legally, women's property relations are entirely different. They can inherit from their parents. They can inherit from their husbands. Divorce is available to both men and women.
Is this the result of what we would call progress? Do you believe in a word like that as a historian? There's a grand, noble term.
Yes, I suppose that historians have trouble thinking about progress, talking about progress, but I would have to say things are better. They're not perfect, and there are aspects of old attitudes which certainly persist, but you wouldn't find a woman in China who thinks she'd be better off 100 years ago.
Patricia Ebrey is a professor of history at the University of Illinois. Her new book is The Inner Quarters, a study of women and marriage in medieval China. The program is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like to have an audio cassette of this week's show. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of discussions for Women's History Month. This week, my guests were Caroline Walker Bynum of Columbia University and Patricia Ebrey of the University of Illinois. For a cassette tape of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 703. That's program number 703, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. Next week, Soundings for Women's History Month will continue. My guests will be Alice Kaplan of Duke University and Teresa Godwin Phelps of the University of Notre Dame. Alice Kaplan will be here to talk about her new book, French Lessons. Teresa Godwin Phelps will also be on hand to discuss her new book, The Coach's Wife. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Additional funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Chang Ching Kuo Foundation for International Scholarly Exchange. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.